Back together again, you and I chatting it up Thursday, June 6th, 2024 on Connecticut Today, where I open the program talking about the 80th anniversary of the D-Day invasion that turned around World War II for the Allies, while Yankee Institute columnist Andrew Fowler talked about Connecticut's contributions to the World War II fighting force. And blogger Lenny Grimaldi stopped by with his weekly update from onlyinbridgeport.com.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man-to-man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air, and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
And with those words, some 80 years ago today, June 6th, 1944, D-Day, within hours of hearing those words, some very, very, very young men, many barely 18 or 19, some lying about their age years earlier to get in, went on to start an Allied invasion on the beaches of Normandy in France, would eventually lead to victory in World War II. That, of course, the voice there, the recorded remarks sending his men into battle of then-general and future president Dwight D. Eisenhower, of course, in that scenario, he was the supreme Allied commander. Several things had to go right, including the weather, for D-Day to happen on that day, and it did, miraculously, some say. A weather front that was in and about the Omaha Beach area on Normandy in France suddenly settled down for the several key hours needed for that. But in looking at these remembrances and watching these brave veterans, you know, many of whom are in their upper 80s and early to mid 90s, some tickling 100, some over, you know, those that can make it with their time limited here on the earth are in Normandy, France, being feted by world leaders, including President Biden. And, of course, you'll hear from some of his remarks on our newscast. But, you know, you think about that and that general era of time, what we tend to call the greatest generation, the World War II generation, which was really the only generation, I believe, and historians, I think, may agree, that was being faced down and came face to face with, you know, evil that was looking to, you know, dominate the world and threaten the American way of life. And you sit there and you wonder, and I'm wondering this too, and I'm sure you are, and I wanted to start off with this at 303-333-9422, 333-WICC. If something like that happened today, would we have, as fractured as we are now, as fractured with the political schism that seems to consume not a great percentage of people on both sides of the aisle, but they're surely the loudest and both sides yelling and screaming at each other, do you think we would have the national purpose for that? You know, a lot of people refer to those as the good old days, and In some aspects they were, and in some aspects they weren't. And listen, you don't have to be some flaming sort of leftist to understand that, you know, the good old days in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s were replete in some areas of the country, not every area, but in some spots it was rampant racism, rampant sexism, rampant misogyny. But when you look at something like we're looking at today, and when we remember perhaps if we had friends or family members or people that maybe were touched in some way by D-Day, whether or not they were in that first or second or third wave on Omaha Beach, or we know somebody in our immediate families or extended families or neighborhoods who had a grandson or a great-grandson or a great-great-grandson who may have been killed in one of those invasions, you sit back and you wonder, and you ask yourself, would we have that same unity today if it happened? I mean, for example, and let's just take something wild here. Is it probably going to happen? No, simply because technology would warn us ahead of a hand. But I mean, looking back 3 years and change before D-Day to December of 1941. I mean, you know, when Pearl Harbor was attacked, and at the time the U.S. military, I mean, it wasn't non-existent, but it was incredibly reduced after World War One, as the U.S. still had its post-war hangover. So if today, for example, China or Russia or somebody took over or attacked Pearl Harbor today, or for example, what if China or Russia, for example, and we doubt it would, but just for the sake of discussion and contrasting it and comparing it with the resolve we had as a nation starting 3 and 4 years ago before D-Day back in 1940 leading up to 1941. Now, obviously, we saw in 39 and 40 what was brewing in Europe there. Would we have the same resolve? What would happen today if suddenly, for some crazy reason that would border on, I guess, insanity, that you had either China, who are not our friends. Now, this is not the Chinese people. I say that all the time. But the Chinese Communist Party, if you think they are in any way our friends, you're out of your mind. They're not. They want to catch up and supersede America in everything, including the military and including the economy and world domination. So they're not. Vladimir Putin in Russia is not our friend. Now, you and I could probably sit down and have a nice dinner or a lunch or a breakfast with a family from Beijing, China, or Moscow or St. Petersburg or wherever back in China, and we'd be fine. We'd be talking about our families, our friends, what we do for a living, what our day is like. But don't stop and think that it is not in the back of their minds that if the U.S. could fall, Russia and China would love that. Do you think, as split as we are over some of the dumbest things on the planet right now, now there are things to be split over, I get it, but some of the stuff is just political junk food, would we have the resolve that we showed 80 years ago today on June 6th, 1944? I mean, think about that. And take a look, especially if you're online and you use social media or you're reading stories online, or even if you're watching cable news today, whether it's Fox or CNN or MSNBC or CNBC or News Nation or whatever, or Newsmax, whatever. I mean, take a look at that stuff and you see those thousands of faces. Thankfully, there were numerous photographers and newsreel people among the U.S. military and others who recorded that stuff. And would we have the unity of purpose today? I like to think we would. And the other thing that strikes me, and I don't mean to be tongue-in-cheek about this, but I think you know where I'm going here. I just have to sit back and laugh, honestly, because, you know, it's one of those things, if you don't laugh, you'll cry. I have to sit back and laugh at, and look, if this is going to sound like a boomer moment for me, well, that's fine, because I'll gladly embrace it. But you take a look at those fighting men. you know, some of whom, especially if they were African-American or Hispanic, were considered second-class citizens in this country. But do you take a look at their faces on these landing crafts and these invasion crafts as they ran up the beach? They knew, half of those guys knew they were going to be, you know, if not instantly killed, you know, they had a good chance to, as the statisticians say, not return or not be left after a few too many hours. And I look at those faces and I watch, again, all the news coverage we seem to see on every June 6th, and it's quite warranted. But today, obviously, it's different because it's 40 years. And you can't help but in a way just shake your head and smile at how many young folks in this country. And again, I'm going to sound like an old boomer, and I don't care because I know I'm right. And you take a look and listen to people who say they have it so hard. Oh, my God, speech. They're afraid of speech. Meantime, you had thousands of guys from multiple nations who were, well, that speech threatens me. No, you know what threatened people back then on June 6, 1944? Nazi guns. That's what they were threatened with. Gunners who had the high ground with high caliber ammunition and bazookas and missiles that were going to be shooting back at them. As opposed to today, where if somebody says something they don't like, they need a safe space. If a speaker is invited to a college that, you know, they don't disagree with, they have to protest and sometimes cause physical damage and burn things like they do at a lot of schools. If a college says, no, we're not going to remove our investment, say, from Israel, they act like spoiled children. They act like kindergartners, and they stomp their feet, and they say they're scared for this and they're scared for that. No, you know who's really scared? You know who's really freaking scared? Those thousands of guys on those landing crafts talking to each other, knowing that likely the pal or the buddy or the pal they had made in the military for the past couple of months, they probably weren't going to see each other, if judging by what they were told by the odds. Welcoming back a gentleman we've had on the show a few times. Andrew Fowler joins us. You can read his stuff, his blogging, his reporting at the Yankee Institute, yankeeinstitute.org. And he posted something a few days ago that I saw and I wanted to have him on, Connecticut and the Second World War. Andy, hi, it's Paul again. How are you?
Doing well, Paul. Thanks for having me back.
So what made you write this? This is a great story. You highlight some Connecticut veterans here. When did the light go off in your head to say, hey, I want to write something about this?
Well, I think it just went off because I knew the 80th anniversary of D-Day was coming up, and I figured I wanted to share their story, share the story of how Connecticut contributed to defeating Nazi Germany and the Axis powers. And that it was a significant contribution. I think what really fascinated me, and actually this is a point made by my old man, my dad, who said that that Waterbury was so industrially significant to the arsenal of democracy, as as FDR called it, that the Luftwaffe was planning to bomb it at one point, that they believed it was a strategic bombing target because it made so much brass and bullets and weaponry for the war to help our boys overseas to beat Germany.
So you decide you want to do this. So the mechanics of the story, how did you find these guys? Lay it out for us, Andrew. How did you, every good writer lays it out. Here's what I want to tell. How do I tell it? Who do I talk to? Walk us through that.
Well, I mean, I came across actually through a friend of mine who showed me a story, incredible coincidental story that took place on D-Day. And it was a guy named Robert Hillman. He was a 20-year-old private from Manchester, Connecticut. He was with the 101st Airborne. So he was an American paratrooper, and he was boarding his C-47 aircraft. And he's inspecting his parachute gear, and he says, quite affirmed that I know my chute is going to be okay. And there was a war correspondent on the plane at the time who asked him, like, you know, how could you be so sure? And he responded, because my mother checked it, and he revealed his mom's initials. And she worked at the Pioneer Parachute Company, which was in Manchester. And, yeah, it just goes to show that little episode. It shows a microcosm of not only of the bravery of the men, the service members who, you know, it jumped, it stormed the beaches of Normandy, landed in Normandy. And there were, you know, overall, there were more than 200,000 people from Connecticut who fought in the war. And more than 4,500 made the ultimate sacrifice. But so it not only shows the bravery on the battlefield, but also the commitment to producing military materials on the home front.
You mentioned Mr. Hillman there, you know, Andy, whenever we mention these men, their age always sticks out. I think you said 20 years old, right? And yep. Immediately, Andy, you know, when I hear this, when I hear, you know, a 19-year-old lieutenant or a 22-year-old major, I don't know about you, but I sit back and say, good God, I was drinking in my dorm room at that age. And these guys were literally putting their bodies on the line there. I mean, I don't know about you, but immediately when I hear about how young some of these guys were, I'm like, my God, I at that age. Now, Andrew, maybe you're a much more masculine man than I was at that age, but I could never conceive of doing that when I was that young.
No, I mean, frankly, I don't know if I could see myself doing that now at 31 years
right?
old. You know, that's why this day is so important to remember. It's just the level of bravery and commitment to duty. You know, so in my previous job, I worked at the Knights of Columbus, mm-hmm. and I had the pleasure of interviewing a guy named Louis Graziano, who is the last living witness to the German surrender, and he stormed. He was part of the D-Day invasion, and he was a young guy. I think he was young 20s at the time, so like probably 20, 21. And he just said, you know, I was doing my duty. I was just doing my job. You know, we had a job to do. You know, come hell or high water, I'm going to do it. And that's really, I think, maybe a lost sensibility now in our, you know, in the subsequent generations. And that's why I felt compelled to write this story in order to share that, share their bravery and to share the fact that, you know, so many of these veterans are now, you know, way upper
yeah.
90s, over 100. It's a fading memory, and it's really incumbent on us to carry that torch forward and
Andrew,
to remember what they fought for, which is our freedoms.
Yeah. Andrew Fowler is the guest with the Yankee Institute. He has a great story. I posted it at our Facebook page, facebook.com/WICC600. Everett Rosine, Andrew, of West Hartford. Tell us a little about him.
Well, well, Everett, I just have to
sure.
recall my memory, he was part of the Bataan.
Yeah, Philippines.
Death
yeah.
March. And he was, you know, the Bataan Death March, I think, is one of the sort of forgotten horrors of the Second World War, where, for those who don't know, who are listening in, after Japan, after the United States and Filipino forces surrendered Bataan in early 1942, more than, it was like 75,000, 76,000 men instantly became prisoners of war. So Everett Rosine of West Hartford, he was part of the Signal Company initially, but he was forced to walk 65 miles from the Bataan Peninsula to prison camps.
Wow.
And more than 10,000 prisoners died on the way. And, you know, he shared his story about how he saw just the absolute brutality of the Japanese toward the prisoners, running over like beating up these guys, and including one man who stumbled and just had a tank roll over this guy and literally squish him in the dirt. It's just, this is the horror that, you know, man can do to one another. And it's a testament to the human spirit in him and the hope that he had to survive, not only survive as a POW for, I think, about 4 years, he said, but survive the war and then continue serving in the military afterwards.
Yeah. A couple of more here that are interesting. Lower Fairfield County here. Ward Chamberlain of Norwalk. Now, Mr. Chamberlain, I see here you say volunteered as an ambulance driver with the American Field Service here.
Yeah. So the American Field Service, again, for brief background, it was a relief organization that was formed in the First World War. And Chamberlain was joined this, and he was part of the he was assigned to North Africa, and he was with the British 8th Army. And at one point, he contracted or was struck with polio, and he was assigned at that point, like, okay, you're going to do desk duty. But he said, you know what? No, I'm going back. And he ended up making his way into the, you know, the invasion of Italy, working on the front lines and helping the wounded from battles, you know, like dragging them out. It's just, again, it's just fascinating to think that, you know, here, you know, young men, much younger than myself now, that were risking life and limb and going above the call of duty to help their fellow man and fellow soldier.
One final allusion here, and folks, there are many Connecticut veterans mentioned in this piece by Andrew Fowler, but I found this interesting. An artist from New Haven, Dean Keller, who rescued Italian masterworks, pieces of art that were under the threat of being looted during the war.
Yeah, it just goes to show the variety of activity that happened during the Second World War. There's actually a great movie called The Train that I thought of, which had Burt Lancaster in it, from the 1950s, 1960s, if anyone wants to watch that. Mm-hmm. And I know that I've never seen The Monuments Men with George Clooney, but I know that's also kind of touches on this stuff of, yeah, like you said, just rescuing art from being bombed. And he's in the Connecticut Hall of Fame, and he was awarded the U.S. Legion of Merit. So again, yeah, it's just, it goes to show that it was not just, that culture, preserving the culture of these countries of Western civilization mattered as well, that were significant. And, Dean Keller, I think I want to write something way more extensive about him because he seemed to have lived a very interesting life.
Well, that'd be cool. You should do that, and then you can make a screenplay out of it, Andrew, and sell it to a major studio, and I can go to work for you and be your assistant. Andrew Fowler. Andrew, thanks, from the Yankee Institute, yankeeinstitute.org. Check out the many pieces he has written, including this one, Connecticut and the Second World War. He compiled info about just fascinating stories about young men, how they contributed around D-Day and before to the Allied victory. Andy, thanks. Good to chat with you, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Appreciate it. Andrew Fowler right there on WICC. I don't like making people yell and scream. That's not good. But Barry, thank you. So it was yelling and screaming because I guess I pointed out something that he didn't like. Man, the fact that I made him yell and scream, I don't know what I got to do. Lenny, should I go to church now? Should I light a candle, Lenny? What should I do? The guy was screaming at the radio. What should I do?
Yelling and screaming, Uncle Paulie, is therapy.
It's true.
Really? We should, like, start a vent center, you know, vent one. You know, you come on and you can scream all you want.
Well,
tomatoes against the wall.
Well, yeah. And what's big now, Lenny? Those axe bars axe throwing, that's big now. We've had a couple of those around here at our events. Yeah. We should do that.
We should have Bridgeport politics every day.
Lenny Grimaldi is here. That's called a segue, folks, in the business, only in Bridgeport.com. Lenny, let's go over your top greatest hits list this week. What's going on with that state Senate district, Lenny? District 22, what do we have?
Well, there you have a four-way primary between a Trumbull resident, Quinnipiac University law professor Sujata Gadkar Wilcox.
Yeah.
You know, former Mayor Bill Finch, who represented the district in the state Senate from 2000 to 2007, City Councilman Scott Burns and ex-Councilman Tyler Mack. So you got a four-person field. Yesterday, a person who was in the field, who qualified for the primary, Shante Hanks, she dropped out recently, and she endorsed the Trumbull candidate. So what you have is the Trumbull candidate getting a boost from a Bridgeport operative, you know, an advocacy person in Bridgeport. She's a state official. And that this is, you know, this means more to the Trumbull candidate than the Bridgeport candidates because she's not as well-known in Bridgeport. And Shante Hanks, you know, she's got a following, you know, in the Wilbur Cross precinct and Park City Maggot precincts. She ran a really close race to State House, almost won it, you know, several years ago against the incumbent Charlie Stallworth. So, you know, this is something, you know, that's measurable for the Trumbull candidate moving forward.
Now we have this, and Lenny, you sent me a note you want to talk about this, and I was hoping so because I saw this and I laughed. A Secretary of the State's office screw up. Lenny, this is not hard. I don't understand how this happens, but I guess our old buddy, our old pal Ernie Newton is getting a little boost here. What's going on with that?
He's getting a latitude of 2 weeks.
Oh, so, my God.
So the way this works is Senator Herengast, the incumbent, he was endorsed overwhelmingly by a delegate at the state convention. And so the state statute says primary petition should be taken out, should be available May 28th, right, for persons desiring to oppose the candidate, the endorsed candidate. It means you got to go hustle a certain amount of signatures to get on the ballot. Well, the problem was they issued, Secretary of State's office, you know, caused a boo-boo. Oh. They issued them right away. So now Newton, instead of having 2 weeks to secure the certified signatures to qualify for primary against Gaston, he now has 4 weeks.
Hey, Lenny, this is why people are cynical. Like, I know you know that, but I'm just setting it up for the audience here. Like, Lenny, how does this happen? Can you explain that to me? How does this happen?
Well, there's a screw up, right? The Secretary of State said, "Well, we went by an old statute. We got it wrong. It was our mistake." No, Gaston is screaming. You know,
about well, he should be. He should be.
They have a lawsuit over it, right? And so, you know, Newton says me a statement. So what is he afraid of? and Gaston sends back a message to me saying, "I'm afraid of guys like Ernie Newton who break the law all the time."
Oh,
right?
Jesus.
So these guys are going at it pretty good. You know, and this is going to heat up. We're only 2 months away, you know, from this primary. And so Gaston's saying he's going to run into court, right? And so here's the statement.
All right, go ahead.
Here's the statement from the SOT spokesperson, right? "When the error was recognized, a legal review determined that the best option was to allow the signed petitions to be valid rather than disqualified. Primary petitions do not require a date along with a signature. It makes it impossible to tell when a voter signed the petition and therefore possible to invalidate the signatures received before the 28th. So, you know, why have a law if you don't follow it, right? That's what Gaston has said. He's saying this is a bunch of baloney. And so I'm trying to reach Gaston. I'm trying to determine whether he's going to file a lawsuit sooner or later. He's going to wait for Newton to be certified for the ballot because he's still submitting his signatures. Or is he going to try to initiate something, you know, pretty soon? So this was, you know, another Bridgeport election could be another lawsuit. What else is new?
Oh, what a joke. Lenny Grimaldi, only in Bridgeport.com. Lenny, here we go again. And I love this because the more endorsements, the better. Because, you know, I love chaos. The Working Families Party endorsing Tyler Mack for the state Senate seat. What's up with that?
Yeah, so the Working Families Party, you know, more and more has been starting to get involved in you know, Democratic primaries and so forth. You know, they could offer Mac a position in the general election if they want as the endorsed candidate for the Working Families Party. But they're getting into it probably right now. They have some resources they can invest into his campaign, bodies on the ground. Tyler Mac is a former city council member who recently moved into the district. He was in the adjoining district, the 23rd.
Mm-hmm.
He recently moved into the 22nd district, probably going to get tipped off from State Senator Marilyn Moore, who's not seeking another term, and she endorsed Tyler Mac. So he's got the backing of the current and retiring State Senator Marilyn Moore and the Working Families Party, which is something to bring to the table for sure. I guess the key thing also is all of these candidates running in the 22nd are seeking public money. And it's a very intensive time. You know, they're not saying a lot, you know, publicly about different issues and things because they're too busy raising money. So my sense is it looks like the Trumbull candidate is going to get there. I would think Bill Finch is going to get there. But, you know, they're probably spending in the next 3 to 4 weeks just focusing so much on getting this public grant, which is $110,000 in the primary. That's not nothing. So you're going to have a very compressed timeline in this, what appears to be a four-way primary, with three Bridgeport-centric candidates and the Trumbull candidate. And it's a, you know, very diverse district. It's third of Bridgeport, all of Trumbull, and a piece of Monroe.
Interesting. Governor Ned Lamont here before we get to the Trump dump for the week. Governor Ned Lamont, I guess he's revving up this ranked choice voting issue again, which, you know, was a big issue when he got some endorsements. Lenny, I'm thinking, and sometimes I like this, sometimes I don't. But, man, if we went ranked choice voting on a state level or even in a municipality like Bridgeport, which I'm sure will never happen, man, that could be interesting.
Yeah, it could be. A lot more options for sure, and it's in a lot of states. So look, the timeline for this is the governor has put together this group that's going to take a look at it. It's a lot of political insiders, you know, that want this. But what they want to do is they want to have a recommendation to the General Assembly for this legislative session that starts in January, the first week of January. And bring it to them, recommend it, see if the legislature, you know, buys into it, if the governor signs it, and then you could see it as early as the municipal primaries next September.
Yeah. Wow. Jeez. Finally, your old boss, Mr. Trump, it certainly looks like the classified documents case, the January 6th case, even the Georgia case is ground to a halt right now. So it looks like, as you and I have been discussing for weeks, Lenny, it looks like this hush money case may be the only conviction they get against him, and the early polls after that really haven't shown a whole lot of movement. So what are your thoughts on this?
It hasn't, you know, and I think the next key test, you know, is this judge going to give him an involuntary vacation, right? And how much will it be? Will the judge give him home confinement? You know, will it keep him out of the joint? I don't if he doesn't do any time, I don't see these polls changing. I think if he gets time, that may be a different standard for some of these voters who are kind of with him or on the fence. It's hard for me to believe, a lot of the pundits are saying he probably won't get any time. It's hard for me to believe this judge, after all this time, millions of dollars,
yep,
getting a lot of grief from the defendant, you know, might not say, you know, let me ping him a little bit. I'm not going to kill him, you know, but, you know, let me give him, you know, a little time to think about it. Who knows? That could change it. But also, you think about, remember all the hullabaloo the Democrats were screaming about RFK being in this thing, taking votes away?
Yeah.
He appears to be taking votes from Trump.
Yeah.
I saw that. So they're not screaming about that anymore, right? Yeah, stay in there. We want you. We hated you before, but stay in.
Stay in.
This RFK stuff is so funny because he's an anti-vaxxer, and I got to take some of his people.
Yeah. Stay in. Lenny, stay in. RFK, sit down. I'll make coffee. Stay here, right where you are. All right. Lenny Grimaldi, only on Bridgeport.com. Lenny, thanks. Appreciate it. We'll talk next week. Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Appreciate it.